Welcome to episode 9 of The Tech Bubble. I'm your host, Ian Williamson, and today we have the first in a series of episodes which tackle the issue of equity, gender, class, ethnicity, disability, sexuality. We consider the technical divide when it comes to access, or what renowned writer Henry Jenkins refers to as the participation gap. But before I introduce our guest for today, our triumvirate of digital leaders discuss what's coming up in the world of tech. What's new? What's on the market? Which may aid your learning? Let's find out. We have Maxine Yang from 13B2, Paul Kim, our regular guest on the show, from 13N2, and finally, Ryan Mack from 12S2.
Hi, and welcome to Tech Review. Today's segment is going to be slightly different from our usual bit, as we're first going to cover a discussion on gender diversity in tech-related jobs. After this, we'll be talking about Jeff Bezos' record launch of Blue Origin. This is Maxine, and as usual, I'm joined by Paul and Ryan.
As mentioned, our first story concerns the employment of women in tech-related jobs. A recent article published by CNBC on the 29th of September 2020 revealed a report stating that it could take up to 12 years for equal representation for women to be reached in tech industries. The study was published by Anitabi as an annual report discussing the overall representation of women in tech, as well as the companies that are taking the right steps to foster a growing female workforce in tech.
Well, in the past decade, the percentage of women employed in the digital workforce has hovered at a mere 25%, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it is continuing to decline. In fact, only about one-third of all employees in the big five tech companies, which are Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, and Google, are women, despite these companies' continued promotion of having a diverse workplace and workforce. In addition, only 37% of STEM majors are female. Given that this low number has persisted virtually since tech companies existed, the obvious question is why? Why are women just not working in the tech field? What are some of the factors that limit women in tech-related jobs that men may not experience? It just seems like a recurring phenomenon every year.
Personally, I believe that quite a few of the factors stem from stereotyping. For example, boys may be considered more into maths and science, and so there's this kind of societal idea that may deter women from working in these types of jobs. And this can lead to workplace discrimination. What I find interesting here is that rates of women in tech today are so low that there effectively needs to be reports such as Anitabi's, which are dedicated to tracking them and their experiences. Whereas in the past, women actually made up a very large part of the workforce in the industry.
That's actually a very clever point, I'd say, overall. There isn't enough awareness raised regarding women in tech jobs. There are annual events such as Girls in ICT Day, but that is only a small step towards gender equity in tech. Clearly, it still takes big investigations to inform our society of the persistent low employment of women in this area.
Well, for our second story, we will be covering a recent development from Blue Origin, which is an aerospace company owned by Jeff Bezos, which recently held a successful rocket launch and landing on Tuesday, October the 13th. The rocket, named New Shepard, is a reusable vehicle and was relaunched for a record 7th time with the intent of testing new NASA landing technologies. It took off at roughly 9:36 a.m. ET, reached an elevation of about 106 kilometers, and landed safely back on Earth after around 10 minutes.
I honestly view exploration of space as a catalyst for technological advancement, because naturally, in order to run proper launches into space, especially those reusable and record-breaking, it takes huge development in machinery, not to mention the costs that are involved in the developments. Having said that, I'm honestly also not sure if aerospace development is a priority at the moment. As phenomenal as the news sounds, I'm a little dubious of what the ultimate goal of aerospace companies such as Blue Origin or even SpaceX is.
Well, no matter what the goal of these companies are, it is clear that with SpaceX, Blue Origin, and tons of other private companies gaining NASA contracts, that space is just being increasingly privatized. And it's especially true with space tourism, where people pay a fee to take a space shuttle into space and tour around. In fact, many people have already signed up to travel to space when the program will begin in around the next decade or so. And that is despite estimates that a one-night stay on the International Space Station will cost upward of $35,000. People just seem to be really excited about visiting the final frontier. Maybe in the future, private companies would be mining on other planets and moons for resources like iron and metal and diamonds and more. That would certainly open up a whole new Pandora's box of business opportunities.
Well, I definitely wouldn't mind being a space tourist. I do have quite a few questions about whether or not this privatization is actually a good thing for space exploration. I think the business competition is leading to more progress than if it were just government bureaucracy, but at the same time, could we be giving companies too much power?
That is definitely a very interesting question to consider, and that is what we'll be leaving you all to ponder until next time. And that is once again the end of our 5-minute tech review segment. Make sure to stay tuned for our next episode. But for now, back to our hosts, Mr. Williamson and Chloe.
Thanks to Paul, Ryan, and Maxime for another excellent segment of the tech review. And to our listeners, as usual, feel free to send any thoughts, reflections, or comments to us at digileaders@webmail.sis.edu.hk. That's D-I-G-I, leaders. We'd love to hear from you. This is Chloe Jazzy Lau, co-host of The Tech Bubble, coming to you with a friendly reminder that you can now listen to all of our podcast episodes on Anchor, Spotify, and the SIS YouTube channel.
Thanks, Chloe. So let's get started with our student guest today. It gives me great pleasure to introduce one of our digital leaders, Ashika Mamgain from 11N2. This is Ashika's first time on The Tech Bubble, and particularly great that we can elicit a student viewpoint outside of the senior section. Ashika has excelled as part of the AFP media course and is a past winner of the Year 9 Photography and Year 10 Horror Awards. Unsurprisingly, her tech-related interests include photography and video editing, whilst Ashika is the head of communications and one of the presidents at the student-led Photo for Good, which is an inter-school network of student photographers providing photography services for charities and non-profit organisations. So, welcome to the show, and I pronounce your name correctly, Ashika.
Thank you. Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. We'll be hearing more from you later on.
And as always, we welcome back regular pundit, veteran of the tech bubble, and Namas house captain, Rohan Williamson from 12N2. What's up, Rohan?
Well, there's always something going on in the world of tech, Chloe. And I imagine that many viewers will be looking forward to the release of all 4 of Apple's brand new iPhones that is scheduled to be announced to the world at 1 o'clock in the morning today. So I trust that all of us will be watching it live together. Chloe, did you manage to get the popcorn? That's the real question. Did you manage to get it?
Of course, I'm sure you'd be pleased to hear that I just got my hands on some for tomorrow morning. Anyway, Rohan, what have you picked up from online speculation about Apple's new iPhone release?
Well, perhaps the biggest one of all being the fact that there are going to be 4 brand new iPhones, which is the most that they've ever released at one given time. And quite interestingly, they've decided that the smallest of their phones, which is still going to come in at 5.4 inches, by the way, everyone, so that's really not very small, is going to be branded as the iPhone 12 mini. And that's quite interesting that they're bringing it across from the iPad franchise name. On top of that, they're also implementing the iPhone 12, which will come in at 6.1 inches, as well as the iPhone 12 Pro, a slightly better version of that, probably with better cameras, although it's unclear as of what the main differences will be right now. And of course, the iPhone 12 Pro Max, the biggest one that you can get at 6.7 inches. And I am really looking forward to seeing that live introduction to what the new iPhones will be at 1 o'clock this morning. I will see you there, Chloe, and I'm sure everyone else.
And Rohan's father is pointing out that although there may be 4 new iPhones that are coming out, Rohan will not be having any of them bought for him. So if he's particularly interested in that, then he'll be buying them himself. Okay, the first of our adult guests is no stranger to South Island School. Alongside her husband, Chris Chapman, she was one of the most familiar faces at SIS between the mid-1980s and today. Hashtag SIS legend for sure. The only female principal we've ever had here at South, more on that later, when she covered the period between the departure of Mr. Silverthorne and the arrival of Mr. Vignoles back in 2018. Annette was a deputy principal at SIS for many years and a key player in bolstering the support that we now take for granted, really, in the pastoral learning curriculum. Did you know, for instance, dear listeners, that the inclusion of a daily tutor period was at the insistence of Annette several years ago? She led a major drive in raising awareness about both student and staff well-being, creating the foundations upon which Ms. Pervaise has continued to build since arriving just over a year ago. It'll be very interesting to hear her thoughts today on the relationship between technology and well-being, which has become such a key area of discussion in recent years, and compounded, of course, by online learning in 2020. It gives me great pleasure to introduce, all the way from the UK, Annette Chapman.
Hi, guys. It's absolutely lovely to hear the work that you've been doing, and I've really enjoyed the podcast discussions that you've been having. It's wonderful to link up with Ruthie and Janice as well. It's great to hear what they've been up to. So what have I been up to? Well, South Island sort of imposes this lifelong learning attitude. So as soon as I got back to the UK, I joined the University of the Third Age, which is a continuation of my learning, and it's learning from other people in my community here. So I've had lots of sort of talks about sort of environmental and some historical courses, which has been quite different. Also, I've got involved in a lot of charity work. I've gone from teaching 14-year-olds at South Island School to 41-year-olds here, a massive leap. And these adults that I'm teaching have all got special needs. And special needs is something that I've always felt very, very passionate about, that special needs children and adults deserve a good education, and they should be allowed to be equal within our sort of learning environment. Moving from Hong Kong to UK was a bit of a shock, but I'm enjoying the seasons and I'm enjoying the outside environment, which is great. As some of you know, sort of I've always had this creative element, and COVID has meant that I've done lots and lots of creative things, including making about 200 face masks for a charity. So it's been a busy year.
You're certainly, yeah, keeping very, very busy, Annette, by the sound of it.
Anyway, it's great to have you on the show, Annette. Second up, a former head girl at South Island. FYI, go check out those plaques on the SIS walls, dear listeners. She is also Mr. Williamson's former TOK student, as am I. And I'm sure they'll have plenty to say on that later today. So Janice graduated from South Island School back in 2014 before studying law at LSE. In her final year, she learned how to code through organizations such as Code First Girls and Udacity, which ultimately led to an MSc in computing at St. Andrews. She's currently completing an interdisciplinary PhD in computer science, also at the University of St. Andrews, where she is, get this, researching the legal applications and ethical implications of privacy, data protection, and technology. Her thesis focuses on how data protection can essentially be thought as a common good to mitigate power imbalances between individuals and companies. I've heard that Janice is incredibly keen on outreach and scientific communication. So over the past 2 years, she's given various talks in renowned places such as the British Computer Society, CUHK Law, the Scottish Parliament, just to name a few. And Janice herself also confessed that, you know, she has a lot of questions about the technology that the law is supposed to govern. For example, technological exceptionalism and how the law is always chasing technology. We would highly recommend visiting the website janicewong.org to check out some of her intriguing work. I know I will right after we hit pause on this recording. Welcome to the show, Janice. We're so glad to have you here with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for the really wonderful introduction. It really takes me back to the years when I was at SIS. And coming full circle, I've also done a little bit of teaching as part of theory of knowledge on data ethics here in Scotland. So I'm happy to talk more about what I do and hopefully answer some questions or get us to all think about some interesting questions related to technology and how it shapes our world today.
And can you believe, Janice, that some students think TOK is pointless? Can you believe that?
who would think that? But it's definitely changed a lot since I studied it with you, Mr. Williamson, because I think we were the last year before the big curriculum change with TOK, before more areas of knowledge and various the subsections and sections were added. So I'm sure things are more interesting and maybe even more topical now than it was before.
And interestingly, I mean, Chloe is now part of the first cohort, alongside Rohan as well, actually, with the new spec, which involves one of the sort of optional themes for the course is knowledge and technology. So I think that's probably something that we'll be talking about again, you know, many times on the Tech Bubble in the years to come. So you never know, Janice, maybe in a future episode we'll get you back on again, and maybe that will be helpful to students who are doing TOK in the school as well. Okay, last but by no means least, a former member of my tutor group, the very first Baha'i house captain, I believe, Ruthie Laidler. Ruthie attended South Island between 2007 and 2014 before studying biological sciences at Durham University in the UK. She cites the starting point of her recent journey with tech as her master's degree in biology. Given that her research project was in genetics, Ruthie was required to take a course in bioinformatics, where she began using Bash programming skills. This was then the catalyst for her work in Ireland as a KDB developer, and when she was contracted to several major banks. Since returning to Hong Kong, Ruthie has begun working for as an analytics developer with a focus on QKDB. Welcome to the show, Ruthie. A lot of acronyms which are perhaps unfamiliar to some of our listeners there. So first of all, I thought maybe you could clarify for us what some of these things like Bash and QKDB, all these things mean.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, thanks for having me. Not only was I a mentee of yours, but I actually also studied food tech under Miss Chapman when I was in year 8.
That's right.
So that brings back a lot of good memories. I didn't become a chef, as you can tell. Okay, so I'll start with Bash. So Bash is probably more commonly used than KDB. It's kind of simply a language that we use on Linux. So if you haven't heard of Linux, it's just a alternative operating system, kind of like Windows or Mac. So the point of Bash is it kind of replaces all of these things that you might do on your Windows or Mac operating system. For example, you might want to drag and drop something into a file. You can simply type a command in Bash and it will do that for you. So you can either run simple commands like that in a shell, or you can write a script that has loads of different commands and it will kind of automate things and make your life a little bit easier. So I focus mostly in my job on KDB and Q. And these things usually go hand in hand. So KDB is a time series relational database, which is used in a lot of investment banks. And actually NASA just recently started using it for some of its astronomy information. And the language that powers KDB is called Q. So Q is pretty fun because it can be used as a querying language, just like SQL, to extract information from these databases. And it's also used to build back-end streaming systems. So we often hear of something called Vanilla Tick, which is powered by Q, and it takes information from different financial sources, and it allows us to stream trade and quote information. I'm not sure if anyone has any questions about that stuff, or I can go into it a bit later.
You have come a long way in the last 6 years, haven't you, Ruthie? Let's be honest about it. I mean, I'd like to be able to turn around and say, and of course, most of that you learnt at South Island School, Ruthie. But yeah, I think most of that has come since, let's be honest about it. There's some fascinating stuff in there, and it was really interesting when you were talking about Linux. One of our head digital leaders from last year, Samuel Bonnekamp, had he been on the show, I would probably imagine we would now have a 5-minute conversation going on between the two of you about Linux. So we'll maybe try and get him on a future show. He'd be very excited to talk to you, let's just put it that way. Thanks very much for that. That's really fascinating stuff, Ruthie, and maybe we'll come back to some of those points later. Chloe.
Yes, so Annette, if we can start with you, we briefly heard about what you're up to now, your life post-SIS. I'd love to learn more about kind of the differences you've found between life in Hong Kong and life in UK and how you've been adapting to these two different countries.
I think one of the first things that I would say is life on the laptop changed completely from the work environment to a non-work environment. So suddenly I was not having to be hooked up to a laptop. Now, I know that in Hong Kong, through the COVID experience, that a lot of you have been doing lots and lots of lessons and things on your laptop. And here, there's been a lot of schools complaining that children here don't all have laptops. There was one family that had five children, and between them they had one laptop and one phone, which were both mums. And there were discussions about how would people sort of share the instruments between the families. So life on a laptop has changed. And I think it's quite important that you actually get out and you do things outside. And that has changed for me. I was outdoorsy in Hong Kong, but I'm even more here. So it's been a big change in that way, I think. What else? I think the other thing is keeping up with friends. I think without having the digital forum, I wouldn't have been able to keep up with friends at all, because coming to a new country, as when people go to university, you don't know anybody. It's quite important that for your own well-being, you keep up with who's out there. So technology has been a massive support in that way.
It's interesting that you bring up that point, Annette, because in recent weeks, we've actually focused on the changing uses of tech, and we've had a lot of discussions on this podcast over the accessibility of tech, as you rightly mentioned, and also just stepping away from tech and really getting out of that tech bubble. Over the last 20 years, through discussions we've had, for example, with people like John Ray, Graham Silverthorne, Mr. Vignoles, and Belinda Greer, we've gotten really rich discussion and conversation surrounding this area. So I believe your journey in school came through textiles, individual needs, and the pastoral system, and eventually an administrative role on the leadership team. Could you perhaps talk us through some of the most significant changes that you witnessed during that time?
It was quite interesting to hear, you know, sort of John, Tom, and Graham's sort of podcast, because I'd lived through all those eras. And it reminded me of the IT journey, which was one of the big changes within school when I first came. One of the things I'll always remember is the trial for the different platforms and the decision behind using Apple in school. So we had a class 9A, and we divided them into 14 children using Apple and 14 children using PCs. And a PC company provided the laptops, and Apple provided 14 laptops. And it was a trial of for teachers as well, to be able to change their teaching styles and to have online learning. And then the students, at the end of the month, the 6 weeks, the students were then polled, as were the staff and the parents. Apple came out tops because there was a lot of innovative work going on in education in Apple at that time. But staff were all using PCs, and we all had small laptops and tablets that we were using that were really very good. So staff weren't very happy with this change, and it was a big expense for school. But we decided, okay, Apple was the way forward. So it was quite interesting to hear the episode, you know, the discussion. The two episodes that the principals also discussed was that they were the ones that focused the changes in the school, so therefore I had to go along with those changes. Now, I changed the pastoral system twice because of the decisions of the principals. When a new principal comes in, they have ideas of what they see, and they analyse what the school is like, and then they try and make sure that they are heading in the right direction. So when I came to the school, we had a house system. And then Mr. Ray decided, no, a year system would be better, so we changed to a year system. And then when Mr. Silverthorne came along, he decided that a house structure was what we needed, and we needed to change the house names. All good things at the time, but education does go around in circles, and it's been quite interesting to actually see that. Looking back at the problems we're facing now and the changes that you've had to make in learning, sort of with the online forum, which reminds me of SARS, and that was a huge shock of starting to do online learning at that point. It was, everything was through email, and all communication with students and setting work was through email. So using Zoom has come a huge way from that. So an interesting sort of development within the school.
It's incredible, isn't it? When you think back to the fact that I would have thought at the time that there was maybe even complaints from from staff or this whole movement towards email and being bombarded with emails, which of course now we kind of take for granted when you move forward another 15 years or so. I was just wondering, actually, as you were talking there, Annette, for Ruthie and Janice, what are your memories of using Max when you first came into school? I mean, do you remember whether there was any kind of controversy amongst students with regards to whether they wanted to be using PCs rather than Macs, or how did you find that process of adapting to being Mac users?
I remember initially, and actually I was cleaning around home and I found the MacBook that I had, and I had the white one, the thick one, and I grabbed it and found it so much heavier than what I'm using now. It's quite crazy to think how quickly the pace of change is for technology. But I don't remember there being much controversy. I do remember the process of purchasing the computer through school. And I think the only complaint I had was that it was really heavy to carry around. But it did, to some extent, become a necessary part of school life then, which is still quite, I consider SIS to be quite an early adopter still of mandating things like that.
Do you remember Mr. Weaver? He used to have talk about the fact that you were talking about the weight of the laptop there, and he used to say, that students should be coming to school with two things: their packed lunch and their laptop. So he was a big believer actually of moving the curriculum, to an online one, which we've actually gradually now, through default, I suppose, with what's happened during online learning, it's kind of moved to that situation anyway. What about for you, Ruthie? What was your memory of that time?
Yeah, I mean, further on from what Janice said, when you mentioned the old MacBook, my shoulders started to hurt. All I can remember was that it was just really dang heavy. I do have a lot of very vivid memories, but I don't particularly remember there being any controversy or anything. I do remember finding it kind of interesting to adapt how the student and teacher relationship changed once we started using MacBooks, because we did have a point at the very beginning. I think we were probably in year 7 when they started introducing the laptops, right? At the very beginning.
Yeah.
It was interesting to see students adapting very quickly to, firstly, making it a lot more efficient to do work, but also then finding ways to be a bit naughty in class, so people were learning how to use spaces, and then seeing how the teachers can react to that straight away.
We teach about that now in our internet, it's actually our laptop induction program, so some of our digital leaders show the parents exactly how students achieve that. So some of those tricks of the trade, unfortunately, are out there in the parent community now. But I think you're absolutely right. There was a kind of transitional phase, wasn't there? And what you've highlighted there is both the good but the not so good of technology. And often it's the students who actually lead the change. So it's actually quite rare now to find somebody, for instance, in school who uses Microsoft Word, because it was the students who just basically decided that Google Docs were better and they could be shared and worked collaboratively with them. And that then dictated to the teachers, look, this is the way we work, so kind of get on board. And most teachers kind of followed suit in that sense. Just coming back to Annette, I suspect that many of our regular listeners to the show will be surprised to hear that it was actually you who encouraged me to apply for the role of Digital Literacy Coordinator at South Island School, going back a few years now. That the very fact that the role exists at all was largely down to the push that came from you at that time, about 6 years ago. So I'm particularly interested to hear your answer to this one, because I don't think we've ever talked about it, but what motivated you, or perhaps put it a different way, can you remember what was happening at that time which necessitated the need for a role of this kind of nature in school?
I think it came about very much because of student safety and how to keep students and staff safe. There was a lot happening with young children, and they weren't aware of the dangers of being sucked into sort of a different world. And I'd been on lots of courses about this. We tried to incorporate a lot of the safety aspect into the pastoral area of the school, but IT was developing across all aspects of student life, and I really felt that it was like you had English and the literature behind English, you had sort of the literacy behind English, you had maths and the literacy behind maths, and then there was this whole digital world that was also as big as the others. So it was developing across all aspects of student life, and this then needed to have someone who knew what students were doing and had relationships with students, but also could address parents' needs as well. And also, don't forget teacher needs, me being one of those. And there needed to be to develop a connection across all of these different areas, providing the framework to teach students and teachers appropriate ways to interpret the constant influx of information in all aspects of education and learning. It needed somebody dynamic, which Ian, you are, but it also needed somebody who could actually communicate with students and somebody who would actually listen to students, which you just cited now that you knew about Google Docs. So it needed somebody that could actually see the bigger picture. You were also a parent as well coming into things. So I saw that as a huge asset because you learn so much from your kids. So the value of student voice and teacher voice was all very important. And I think what you've built from it is excellent testimony to what my vision was at the time, and you just took that on board. So I think, you know, I think it's been great. What we're doing now is, you know, is excellent.
I think it's great to have that kind of, you know, narrative overview, and I think what you've highlighted there is the importance of sort of the kind of triangulated role where we're dealing with all of those stakeholders, you know, with both, you know, the student development in terms of digital technologies in school, teachers as well, of course. And in school, we continue to talk about things like not only the ISTE student standards, but there are also standards for teachers as well. And I think you absolutely rightly highlighted that, of course, parents have got to be involved in that process too, which is where, you know, websites like Common Sense Media, and more recently, technological sites like Humane are going to be increasingly important in educating parents about, you know, changes that are taking place, the applications that their kids are using. I like that idea of the triangulation of the three.
As a student, it's really interesting to hear about the origins of this role because, you know, how it came from an idea into forming such a significant role in our lives now. You know, Mr. Williamson, the digital literacy coordinator, that role led on to something bigger, that was the DLC. And now through the DLC, we're running lots of initiatives that not only allow teachers to be the conduits of these digital literacy and digital well-being ideologies, but students alike as well. So we, you know, as digital leaders, we are responsible for essentially spreading the safe use of digital technology, which I think is great because it's almost made it autonomous in terms of how we're really looking at technology at South Island. So it really strikes me that when Janice and Ruthie graduated, you know, back in 2014, that the implementation of this role in SIS just narrowly missed the both of you. So during your time at SIS, did either of you feel like there were some crucial 21st century skills that were brought about by, of course, the digital advent, like coding, for example, that both of you are very well versed in, that were simply not offered during your time at SIS that you would have liked to have explored?
I personally don't think, you know, and maybe I'm biased because I've been on both sides of the coin when I did a degree that was very much text heavy, not visual, not creative in that sense. But I don't think that necessarily learning how to code is important for digital literacy and understanding technologies in the same way that, you know, you're able to use a toilet without necessarily knowing how to plumb it or how to fix it if things go wrong. And so I think that actually if you acknowledge how interdisciplinary or how transferable skills are. For example, in the context of thinking about coding or computer science, you know, you can learn about language through languages or through philosophy, and you can learn about logic through mathematics. So actually, I don't think that, you know, I wouldn't describe it as having missed out or missed the boat or not the right time necessarily. I think it's just about being able to think in a way that, you know, is more open-minded. And I think, for example, theory of knowledge is actually a good way of bridging that gap and encouraging students to think more widely and seeing how they can attach some of what they have learned, whether that is in terms of content or in terms of skills, into other disciplines and other areas of their learning.
Can I ask you, Janice, just for quickly, we hear from Ruthie as well. When you left South Island, did you think at the time, one of the things that I want to do when I go to university is I want to you know, teach myself some coding skills? Were you already aware of the need for that? Or is that something that kind of evolved later on, you know, as we got sort of, you know, 2016, 2017, a few years later?
It was definitely something that only evolved later. I knew that I wanted to study law at university or as part of my undergraduate degree. It was something that I was interested in. But I've always been interested in technology and I've always been curious about it, particularly from the lens of my current research in terms of privacy and data protection. In the context of my cohort or mine and Ruthie's year, I was actually one of probably the later adopters of technologies like WhatsApp because I was concerned about the amount of data that applications such as that collect in a way that potentially didn't seem like a concern, or the priorities were on innovation rather than, or on communication rather than those sorts of things. But this was an area that I'd always been interested in. And because of certain things that happened at university or other opportunities or being, you know, being able to go to events and things kind of opened my eyes up a little bit and kind of allowed me to navigate the path that I'm currently on now.
And of course, with something like The Social Dilemma that's come out on Netflix recently, and, you know, we've started to speak about quite widely on the DLC, I would imagine that it will probably be discussed, you know, more widely at a school level as we go forward, certainly if I have my way with it. Those issues of privacy and, you know, the way in which your data is essentially being hijacked in many ways has never been more relevant. I mean, you know, the debates that are coming out of I mentioned earlier on, you know, Humane, the Center for Technology in the US. I mean, they're pushing this very, very strongly at the moment. So I would have thought that you're probably in very high demand, Janice, in terms of the area, the sort of niche that you've been carving out there.
It's definitely an interesting area to be right now. I'm not sure about demand, but it's good fun, and it gives me a lot of opportunities to share some of my thoughts and some of my work on different platforms and apply them to different contexts.
You fell into my trap perfectly there, by the way, Janice, because that means obviously the next step will be inviting you into school to speak to everybody. Ruthie, what about you in terms of the similar kinds of issues from your side?
I would say that I agree with Janice in that, technology is not always just about coding. Like, there are so many other kind of disciplines and career paths that are related to technology. But I disagree in that I wish that we had learned coding while we were at school, because it wasn't until after I finished university or sort of towards the end that I realized how much coding is actually integrated into our lives. So to be a programmer is not only just, you know, being holed up in a tiny room and kind of typing like the Matrix, right? Nowadays, pretty much everyone can benefit from doing programming. So if you have a look, say, on Indeed.com, right, and you are looking for a fashion job, I know someone who is working in fashion, and he was asking me, how come they are all asking me for experience in coding languages, like, they may ask you for some querying languages to do database management, or they may ask you for some website expertise. And it's something that we were not really made aware of when we were younger. So I think to learn it from a younger age would have been a lot more beneficial, no matter what kind of discipline you wanted to study, in my opinion. And I only really remember us learning ICT when we were in KS3, and we were kind of taught more specific skill-based lessons. For example, like we did a module on Excel, or we did a module on Microsoft Word, which, as you said, is not even really that relevant anymore because there are much better ways to collaborate with other students. And it wasn't really pushed as a subject to like that was a viable subject to study further. So I believe we only had, Janice, correct me if I'm wrong, but like a handful of people study it into the IB and then at university. And I definitely think we did develop some transferable skills in other subjects, but I do wish that I had been a bit more interested and taught a bit more about the relevance of technology when we were a bit younger.
It's interesting as well that, I mean, when we met recently, Ruthie, we were talking about the sort of niche carved out for itself by organizations like FDM in Hong Kong. So, you know, I'm not sure, it's certainly not just South Island School, was it? There was a kind of shift in the sands that took place around about that time over a 2 or 3 year period where suddenly we were inviting guests, and you remember this, Annette, where we had guests who were coming into school and they were talking up the value of coding at that time. And suddenly I think ICT, as you described it, which to be honest, I think some of the students back in, you know, like 2010-11, they kind of knew a lot of those skills already. They were coming to secondary school having already figured out how to use Microsoft and, you know, Microsoft Word and Excel, etc. So suddenly there was this massive leap where the availability of teachers who had those kind of skill sets were at a premium. And, you know, you may have noticed that one of our previous shows had Tom Lee, who's been at the school for many years, who's just bringing computer science in now. And it's in recognition of the kind of groundswell of students who are demanding these kind of skills, you know, albeit several years later. Okay, I suppose that is a nice catalyst, really, for thinking that fast forward 6 years and we go to 2020. And I suppose the real test here is asking the current students where they think we've reached in supplementing these skill areas. So Ashika and then Rohan, keeping in mind, by the way, guys, if nothing has changed, I'm likely to get sacked. So no pressure here. What are your thoughts on the opportunity to study, for instance, coding? But I take Ruthie's point. Coding is only one part of the technological landscape. But obviously an important one at the moment. Ashika, let's start with you.
Okay, don't worry, Mr. Williamson, no one's getting sacked. I believe coding is something that's fundamental, as many of the skills and attributes involved in coding can help students to thrive in the digital age, especially now. With the number of Adobe programs offered to students in school, I think the DLC has actually helped me a lot in terms of like supplementing these skills areas. I think our school's coding club is something to be really proud of. I myself actually attended the coding club for one full term. I believe this was during year 9 when my friend Christy, whom some of you may know from episode 6 of the Tech Bubble, she convinced me to join the coding club and just feel things out. Unlike Christy, I wasn't really much of a tech savvy person, so when I first joined the club, I was a bit overwhelmed by how much went into coding. I mean, it literally took me a week to understand the difference between a div and a span element. However, despite my lack of experience in coding, I still learn a lot, and I don't regret it at all because in hindsight, it actually helped me a lot out in school because I knew the basics of things like HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And as previously mentioned at the start of the podcast, I'm currently in the middle of my AFP media course, which stretches over years 10 and 11. And during this course, one of the units we actually covered in class was coding. And we had to make our own e-portfolios completely from scratch by following a course on BSD Launchbox. And, you know, ever since joining the coding club, I got a bit of experience. And because of that, I've always kind of enjoyed coding or like found it really fun. So even though I did struggle a bit, the good thing was that I could always kind of, I had a lot of support. So whenever I was stuck, I could send my issues over to BSD. They would immediately respond to me. And even teachers would help me in class. So everything was like really easy for me as a student. And I think the point I'm basically trying to make here is that the opportunity to study coding has always been there and support is always there for us students whenever we need it. And it applies, this like applies to not just me, but everyone. You don't necessarily have to be a media student to try coding. But, I mean, that's what our school's coding club is for. I think it's just a matter of curiosity and encouragement, as a lot of students in our school are perhaps just not aware of our coding club, or perhaps even just a bit apprehensive to try something new.
I think you've hit upon there as well a really important change, which is that there are more and more teachers now as well who recognise that, you know, because there are so many languages out there, yeah, you cannot be an expert in all of them. And there are so many technological skills that are available to students. So I think, you know, having that kind of, I suppose it's a change in pedagogy where you say, look, you know, in your particular case, Christy Poon knows a lot more about coding than I do. So why doesn't she just run the class, as did Samuel Bonnecamp before her? So, you know, you've got this much more kind of flat teaching structure now where I'm not saying that that is a long-term solution, by the way. I don't think it's a good situation where you don't have expertise necessarily in an area, but we do. But it's as what I was saying before, that groundswell of the students has kind of brought it full circle so that last year, it wasn't even me who had to really go to leadership team to persuade them about bringing computer science in. I mean, I was the front person for it, but it was a given. And people like Mrs. Crouch was coming to me and saying, we've got to get computer science into the curriculum. Listen to what the students are saying, listen to what the parents are saying. So, you know, there are some, you know, people who you wouldn't even necessarily expect who become huge advocates of that change in school. So it's interesting to hear your journey there. What about from your perspective, Raham?
Well, first of all, I couldn't agree more with Ashika. I think it's nowadays virtually impossible to go through all of the years at South Island School without at least having the opportunity to learn some coding fundamentals. For example, something that I think I was only recently introduced to within the school curriculum, or was only just introduced over the past few years, is the opportunity to construct video essays. And in my experiences from both completing the AFP Media course and having just started the IB Film course, we have had the opportunity to create our own video essays through these coursework assignments. This requires taking video footage, images, graphics, etc., and then incorporating them along with your own commentary in an essay-like format. And I think the video essay assignment in AFP Media was a lot more focused on the student analysing the different ways in which recent news stories were being presented, as well as having quite a large focus on discovering where the true sources of information were, or as they were named on the tool, TrustaVista, where the patient zero was. I'm sure, as you would expect, this task involved a lot of research and statistics on behalf of the student, as well as the use of graphics to make it more engaging, make it more relevant. And in the film course that I'm studying at the moment, in IB Film, the video essay coursework task is not something that we've actually done yet, but I have been sneaky and checked on the syllabus just ahead of time, just so I know what to expect. And it's more focused on comparing two films and contrasting them at the same time, which would involve taking bits of footage from these two films more than having things like graphics to show in the video, in order to sort of show what it is more specifically that you are comparing and contrasting. And I think as a result of that, there is some courses within South Island School now that I think are definitely starting to become more digital literate as time is progressing, to sort of include a type of editing skill that is becoming, I think, ever more mainstream across the world now than perhaps ever before. And in particular to that, I'd quite like to sort of throw a question out to Janice and Ruthie. I'd be really interested to know if you guys have come across video essays, whether it be at university or just being exposed to it at some point in your lives. And if you have, what was your overall impression?
I'm thinking back to when we created, you know, videos using iMovie on our laptops. And I think I wouldn't describe what we did was video essays, and I'm not sure that, I guess particularly because I studied law, that, you know, it wasn't something that we did or were encouraged. I don't even know if academics know what video essays are.
Yeah, we're ahead of the curve.
But definitely ahead of the curve. And, you know, I would describe what we did before was more video presentations. They might have included aspects of video essay content that you mentioned in terms of actually commentating on certain things or adding your own thoughts and opinions, but I wouldn't say that that was something that I did in school or at university.
Do you think that'll become anything to do with your current project, Janice? Is that a medium that may well be useful as you go forward? You know this ability to rip footage, which become examples, so that the essay, I suppose the essay structure, which has stayed very similar, you know, for such a long period of time, has begun to evolve slightly. And, you know, film is not the only IB course which has a video essay element in it. Digital society, which is on its way as well, which replaces the old information technology in a global society, which was around when you and Ruthie were doing the IB. That will also incorporate some kind of digital essay format. So is that the kind of thing that you think you'll use in the future, do you think, in your work? Or will it remain a more conventional essay format?
I'm not sure. I think it's something that could possibly fit in. I think that when it comes to the digital environment that we're in now, it's really important that the content that is presented, because there's so much content available, that the information is actually interesting and engaging to watch and interact with. And I think video essays are a good way of doing that.
Really quick question, Ruthie, to you as well, is, you know, how do you see the applications of video essays or potentially a similar kind of digital format of information presentation of case studies within the work that you do at the moment?
Like Janice said, when we were at school, we sort of just dabbled in iMovie. So we kind of made presentations. And actually, when I was studying biology, I also did some forms of presentation. But like she said, particularly while I was doing my master's, a lot of it was still very academically old-fashioned, I would say. So we were told that, oh, you can incorporate movies into what you do, but at the end of the day, you have to stand up in front of 200, 300 people and make a case for yourself. In terms of my work, I don't really see that much video essays, I would say, but that being said, I have seen this kind of technology kind of being incorporated into other business drives, I guess. So video essays are something that I've seen in terms of perhaps diversity groups within the company that I'm working for. So it can be used to make information more accessible to people, what with different time zones and people working at different hours. It's something that we can use to relay information with, like, internally within to do things like that, yeah.
Especially now you don't have to use the same big heavy white MacBook anymore. Now it's become much more easy to create as well.
You can access it from your phone or your iPad after work, on your way to work. Just makes things a lot more accessible, and I'm really impressed that you guys are doing it now at South Island, because it will be a true testament to the content of work that you guys are producing, and also, you know, your digital literacy skills. So yeah, I'm really impressed.
I'm glad you brought up diversity and kind of the accessibility of information, because I'd love to hear what else is doing with the use of technology in order to increase the access of diversity, equality, and inclusion within the tech industry and within the workforce.
So I am probably not the best person to comment on this, but I know within actually is a it's a business group called Women on the Move. So there are multiple business groups within, and actually a lot of other investment banks that are being used to drive diversity and equality within, you know, the investment banking sector. And I can only really comment on tech. I actually sit on one of these business group chapters, but for Pride. So the LGBTQ+ and allies. But I do know that there is a group called Women on the Move, and they're very involved in providing mentors for people and reaching out and trying to give workshops in terms of, like, whatever people who are slightly younger, women who are slightly younger, want to do and learn from people who have more experienced careers.
Yeah, and the reason I ask that is because one of our central themes in our second season of the Tech Bubble is actually diversity, equality, and inclusion. And I'm sure it comes as no surprise, dear audience, to you all, that women face incredibly high barriers of entry in the tech industry. And I'm not sure if Janice or Ruthie have faced that, and we'd love to hear some of your experiences later as well. But for some stats, according to a McKinsey study in 2018, which was, by the way, graciously dug up by our brilliant research team, team, so shout out to you guys. And so while, you know, computer science sparks interest in 47% of middle and high school girls, that percentage actually drops to 19% of women getting CS degrees, and ultimately a staggering low of 11% of senior leadership positions in tech companies held by women. So how's that for some stats, everyone? Janice, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. So given your considerable experience of working with tech and obviously writing about tech from an insider's perspective, what kind of challenges do you think young women face in pursuing STEM careers today? And what have some of your experiences been in terms of the barriers that you might have faced yourself within the workforce?
Yeah, I think quite fortunately, I've been surrounded by people who have been very supportive of engagement with technology and getting more girls and more women into STEM subjects. And I think that some of the challenges and conversations have moved on from just thinking about getting more diversity, whether that is gender, whether that is race, religion, nationality, into the field. And the question has become more about how do you actually retain this group of people? For example, as you mentioned with the statistics about people being interested, how do you keep this interest going? And how do you actually encourage people to stay in the workforce? And there was actually a recent report by Accenture and a tech educational organization called Girls Who Code. And this is based in the US, but it found that half of young women who actually go into tech jobs leave by the age of 35. And so there are big questions about why that is. And a lot of people cite that this is because of non-inclusive company culture and the infrastructures that come with kind of getting raises, going into more senior positions. And this involves wider questions about how do we actually support people who are maybe not traditionally seen as people who work in STEM. And it's very interesting historically as well about how the gender roles in particular has changed, because back when there were world wars, it was traditionally women that took these roles in technology and programming and software engineering and computer science. So what happened in between in terms of the actual systems and in terms of the organizations that build and create technologies that has changed that makes this company culture perhaps not as inclusive as it could be?
Yeah, I've actually got some stats with regards to women in the gaming industry on the whole, which is, you know, quite a big sort of industry and very prevalent at this moment in time. And thank you very much once again to the Digital Leaders and the Tech Bubble research team for providing me with the statistics for today. So according to an article by Wired.com, there is a very large disparity between male protagonists as compared to sort of female protagonists in the gaming industry on the whole. Only 21% of people presenting at E3 identify as female in terms of gaming, so make of that what you will. In terms of esports, according to an article written by GameCreate.com, since there are no physical differences really between men and women in gaming itself, there is an interesting question to be asked, which is, why is there such a lack of female esport professionals? And this article goes on to talk about how it is an extremely male-dominated culture, meaning the barriers, as we'd mentioned before, for entry for women are very high. And gaming in general is seen more of a masculine thing to do. And this may be because of a lack of female representation to draw in a larger female demographic, as mentioned before. But interestingly, according to the final article which I'm going to mention, which was written by Athena40, the idea of games as a male activity is becoming less prevalent. And this is sort of backed up by a statistic by Statista that almost 10% of the total gamers are now women, according to 2019, based on the last decade. So there are some interesting statistics there for you viewers. Make of them what you will.
It's also interesting that continues. I mean, for the benefit of Janice and Ruthie, that continues to be an incredibly polarizing issue. I'm going to come back to some of the points you made in a second, Janice, but given that Ryan's just mentioned some of those esports stats, which does interest you know, a large segment of those who sign up to be part of the Digital Leadership Council. We had our first esports tournament in school a couple of years ago. But obviously during a period of time, as we've had in 2020, where there's been so much time spent in front of screens already, encouraging students to then, you know, give up their evenings, for instance, to continue playing games, etc., you know, becomes problematic, and understandably so in terms of many of our stakeholders. There is actually a league coming to Hong Kong in the not too distant future, and I think this is going to force the issue, I think, a little bit in terms of where we stand on this, because there are obviously a lot of very keen students in this arena, which is an alternative to physical sports in the traditional sense, and certainly from some of the kind of documentaries I've been watching about the kind of top gamers in these areas, it actually is increasingly involving a lot of training, and I mean physical training rather than just sitting in front of a screen, to be at the top of your field in those areas. Just an aside, and something we're going to come back to, because the DLC wants us to, in episode 12, so a little plug going forward. Janice, I just wanted to pick you up on one of the expressions that you use there, and this is for those of our younger students in Bohemia, for instance, in years 7 and 8. So for some of the younger listeners, when you mention things like non-inclusive company culture, can you elaborate a little bit on this point? I mean, what kind of inclusivity issues exist in the workplace that all of our students, regardless of gender, should be aware of going forward?
Sure. I think that when we talk about non-inclusive company culture, and I talk about this broadly and not just in the context of STEM or in the technology industry, we're looking at some of the discrimination or biases or lack of support that we actually see in society manifest within a company or within an organization. So for example, traditionally, women are seen as the gender that predominantly cares for a child should a family decide to have children. And so when we talk about non-inclusive company culture, this could mean things like there isn't paid maternity leave or a very short amount of paid maternity leave within company, or there's no childcare support going forward, or that sometimes the hours are unfriendly for those who have to send children to school, and those sorts of things, or even working over the weekends, which there are also cultural differences more generally between different parts of Asia and Europe and America. And also, of course, when it comes to kind of non-inclusive culture, we're also looking at attitudes towards people who are potentially of a different race or a different religion. We don't take those considerations to account and actually have biases towards them, whether they're unconscious or whether they are conscious. And actually seeing if there's a way that there is a code of practice or having a code of ethics in place within the company to make sure that there are reporting procedures if anything goes wrong or if there's misconduct being made there, and how to actually make sure that everyone who wants to participate can participate in the way that they want to.
Great answer. Thank you, Janice.
Ruthie, I'd actually love to hear from you on this point as well. So we've heard Janice's perspective, and it seems like non-inclusive culture is not having the existing infrastructure to help women get the same opportunities in the workplace. So what do you make of the phrase non-inclusive culture that Janice brings up? You could look at this question from the point of view of your own experience, just generally based off what you've heard from other people that have experienced similar issues within the workplace. I'd love to hear what you think.
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, I'm pretty lucky in that I work for a company that has a large focus on diversity and inclusion, but that isn't to say that I haven't received my fair share of, I would say, non-inclusivity or kind of discrimination more outside of the workplace, just based from people I know, maybe peers. I agree in that there is kind of a lack of representation of women in tech. And women are traditionally not really seen as, able to do coding or able to work in technology. It is uncommon to have women in position of power, which I believe may be one of the problems. So I think if we were to try to be a bit more inclusive for girls and people who identify as women in tech, we really need to start from the ground up. So start with people from school. And I think that's something that companies should really be pushing for. You know, as I was saying earlier, there was a really small handful of people who went into tech from our year. And I believe that none of them were women. I may be wrong, but I'm pretty sure. And I think that pushing technology to women in their younger years is probably something that a lot of people can do to make sure that their companies really are being inclusive, because it's all well and fine to say, well, you know, we have this many people in positions of power, this many people's in position of power, but by not moving more people into the company, you're not going to be able to retain those people. Yeah.
It's interesting. I can maybe bring Annette in relation to what you've just said there, Ruthie. So, you know, Annette, when you compare your own youth and then the opportunities that are afforded to young women at this time in the workplace, and it's interesting because we, you know, we're talking obviously here about, you know, almost kind of a retrospective on the last, you know, 5 to 6 years with Ruthie and Janice and their experiences. Then we've got Ashika, who's currently in year 11. She's going to have another, what, 2 and a bit years before she gets to university, and then another 3-4 years, however long, before she then gets into the workplace. I mean, do you think that progress has been made when you compare, you know, your own experiences? You know, if you go back to, for instance, when you were Ashika's age compared to now, how do you see that one?
I think huge changes have been made. You know, I was very lucky. I had a very progressive father who pushed me as much as possible, and being a girl was not a reason not to do something. He was the one that encouraged me to drive, to travel abroad, take risks. These weren't things that girls did at my age. I remember when I first went to Hong Kong and actually seeing women in the construction industry and being equal to men, and realising that this was a completely different kind of female equality that I wasn't sure if I wanted to be part of, but it was there. Chloe said about women facing incredibly high barriers of entry into the tech industry. I'd like to question this. You know, it's always been said that women are the weaker sex. There's nothing in education that's been denied to girls. Why are there such incredible barriers? I'll just give you an example. My daughter, she's a real fighter of women, women in a role in society. And she's always pointed out that women in science are not the norm. She actually commented the other day that it'll be another white man that will get this job, mum. She feels that there's a huge discrepancy also in higher education and within the whole science field. Biology seems to be the only way that women get into science. They don't seem to pick up the physics, the chemistry, etc. So what are these high barriers that women in the tech industry are actually sort of facing? Are they actually imaginary barriers? Is there something about the role? I don't know. Ruthie said it comes back to schools, and I fully agree here. What are we doing in schools to prevent girls from getting into these subjects in the first place? I really do think that we need to perhaps look much younger. Is it the parents' influence that is stopping girls? I don't know. One massive movement here at the moment is Black Lives Matter, and it's really rocked the whole world, I think. And I'm hoping that this will also rock not only sort of the diverse cultures, the ethnicities, but also gender equality across everything, so that girls can come out of the norm. It just seems to be an inbuilt hereditary thing that girls go one way and boys go another. We need to rock that. We need to change it.
Definitely. Ms. Chapman, I'm glad that you brought up the point of kind of whether there are barriers at all, or whether it's kind of this implicit barrier that we've set ourselves, almost these psychological barriers that maybe have been brought about by upbringing, by mindset. But also I wanted to just bring it back to a point that Janice rightfully mentioned, is about the kind of infrastructure and also a sense of implicit bias within the workforce. I think that's the most significant barrier to women, not only in the tech industry, of course, but across various various industries where women are underrepresented is that they can get in. And we're kind of discussing the difference between diversity and inclusion, right? So diversity is having X percent of women in the workforce. Inclusion is making sure that X percent of women have the tools and infrastructure and means to succeed within that workforce and are not only in there for a merely tokenistic purpose. So I think that's a great point you brought up there. And I wanted to quickly plug our next episode that's going to be on diversity and inclusion in the tech industry. So look out for that. Back to Ashka. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this point. You know, Mr. Williamson mentioned graduation and the perhaps daunting prospect of almost going into the workplace for perhaps 5 to 6 years from now after you graduate. So I wanted to ask whether you think you'll have the full choice of jobs offered and opportunities offered to you compared to, let's say, Rohan, for instance, in 5 to 6 years' time when you do get to this phase of your life.
Well, the way I see it, gender equality has definitely become like a recent development among the major corporations in the world. Some of the most well-known companies have had women CEOs in the past. For example, Indira Nooyi, the ex-CEO of PepsiCo. And I totally like think that in recent years that gender equality has become an accepted norm in society, and it's being catalyzed and supported by legal frameworks and equally supported at various national government and international organizations. So, I mean, another more recent example would be Mary Barra, the CEO of General Motors. So, like, for sure, 5-6 years from now, I truly do believe that I would possibly have the full choice of jobs afforded.
You know, it's interesting that Ashka brings up legal frameworks. Janice, I'd love to hear your thoughts really quickly on this. Is given that you were a law student and you did a bit of law back in your undergrad studies, how do you think certain legal frameworks can be changed or implemented better support women to enter the workforce with less barriers?
I think that the laws that exist more generally around the world and certainly in the developed world are to some extent already there. I think obviously, for example, coming back to maternity leave or paternity leave, there are different numbers across different regions. And I think one of the challenges is actually the enforcement aspect of that, and particularly related to what kind of my research in data protection. We have in Europe, the General Data Protection Regulation, and that's a very strong, overarching piece of legislation. But on the enforcement side, it might not be as strong as it should. But I think that the solution is probably not necessarily a legal one when it comes to making sure that workplaces and industries are more diverse and inclusive, because it's actually about changing the culture and recognizing the benefits when there is equity and when there is parity. And that, you know, and I think using the pandemic as an example, a lot of governments that are led by women have seen successful ways in actually combating the virus. And this is the same when it comes to companies and cultures. So it's not necessarily about making a business case for why we should have diversity and inclusivity, but actually recognizing that when we all work together, in an environment that suits everyone, maybe not the best in particular ways, but actually finding a balance there is really important. And that could look very different for different companies and organizations.
Well, thanks so much for that, Janice. That's an intriguing point and a brilliant segue into our final question for all our guests here with us today. So what advice would you give to girls that are interested in STEM but do not know where to start or might be almost intimidated by the prospect of entering into this uncharted territory? So keep your responses concise within 30 seconds to a minute. And I'd love it if you could kindly start us off, Annette.
Okay, so STEM is a hugely exciting area, offers the chances for people to continue to change the world. STEM subjects are vital to us and are the fuel that powers our innovation. So a STEM subject seems tough. SIS has incredibly intelligent students, but are the subjects still seen as too difficult? Or is it a misconception that STEM careers involve spanners, overalls and dirty hands? This might especially be the case with parents, rather than, you know, today's high-tech reality. Is it seen as a lower income or middle class profession? What is turning off students at South Island? Sir James Dyson of Dyson Engineering believes that STEM has historically got a poor deal from governments and establishments. So do students see it as an area that money is not being spent on? In the UK, there has been 20% rise in the number of students taking STEM subjects since 2010. The number of students from SIS going to university to study STEM subjects are extremely low. If you look at the career sort of table, it actually shows STEM subjects has been one of the lowest areas. So SIS needs to consider how this can be addressed. Is it the education of parents? Parents in Hong Kong have a massive high expectation for their children. So is it a question of actually educating parents? So possibly food for thought there. So girls, STEM is a fundamental key to a bright, better, healthier future for everyone. Girls are always passionate about their world. Look at the support that SIS have given the environmental issues at school. So girls really need to get on board with this.
Janice?
Sure. So the main piece of advice that I have from personal experience is that it is never too early or too late to start. There are a lot of ways to get involved with STEM subjects and with the tech industry. And there are a lot of freely available resources online that you can read up on to see what most interests you. Participation in STEM isn't just about coding and programming, but actually also about the societal problems, such as those mentioned in The Social Dilemma, that need to be addressed in ways that involve technology without necessarily using technical skills. So I think that if you stay curious about the world around you and keep an eye out of how technology impacts the particular area that you are interested in, for example, whether that's legal technology or computational architecture or educational technologies, then I think that you're already miles ahead of the curve.
Ruthie?
So my advice would be, firstly, not to be afraid to be loud and ask questions, because not only will you learn stuff, but you'll actually also make yourself known. I think too often when we're young, as girls, we're told not to be too loud for fear of coming across bossy or annoying, but it's time we start expressing ourselves and changing that expectation of us. Secondly, I'd say failure is completely normal and part of how we should be developing as girls too. So don't be afraid to try something and fail at it. Humility is really important, but it's also important to learn that it's okay not to be embarrassed by mistakes that you've made. Lastly, if you really are interested in pursuing a career in technology, make sure you seek out support from other women and realize that you're not alone. I think you need to find someone to help you break the glass ceilings that you may face. I think connecting and supporting with other women can be really incredible and valuable intrinsically, but can also lead to better and more efficient work.
I think perhaps one of the most positive things about the younger generations in society, particularly the likes of Generation Z and my generation, is that equality on the whole is becoming far more of the norm. It's increasingly more and more frowned upon for individuals to exert patriarchal or discriminatory values on communities, and in which movements such as, for example, Black Lives Matter have made it very clear that issues such as institutionalized racism within the US police force will not be tolerated anymore. And as such, I really do have great optimism that the world is going to be a more inclusive and accepting and a better place for people of our generations. And whilst I think that there is still definitely gender bias in the workforce, including STEM, I do think that there is a philosophy instilled in every student at South Island School, which has been, very simply, to make a difference. And whilst there are challenges that may arise, I would advise to this person just to follow their passions and to join some of the clubs that had been mentioned, such as the coding club Ashika had previously mentioned. And my advice, as simple and as cheesy as it may sound, would be to just follow your dreams and give it a go, because if you never take that first step, then you will never know what arises out of that. And never take no for an answer.
I couldn't agree more with Rohan. My advice would simply be, don't be afraid to try something new. For me, our school's coding club was my starting point, so as a word of advice, I would definitely recommend joining the coding club, as coding can definitely help prepare you for STEM-related careers. I know things may seem daunting at first, but as you learn more about it, I can promise you it's worth it. And honestly, you got this. And if you're still struggling to find out, like, where to start, you can always talk to anyone at the DLC or to some of our amazing media teachers, and you can actually get the chance to talk to people who are actually doing STEM-related activities. So, yeah, don't be afraid to seek support and try to put yourself out there.
And if I can maybe just very quickly add on to that, I think it's fantastic that one of the things that's happening in not just in our school but across many schools worldwide now is that, going back to, you know, points that I think, you know, Annette and Janice and Ruthie were making as well, that this is becoming integrated across subjects. You know, those kind of digital literacy skills that we've been talking about, you know, yes, they have a place in media, but they also have a place in mathematics as well. You know, some of the most innovative stuff that we've seen in the curriculum recently has been through the use of iPads that the staff in the maths department have employed. You know, we've seen, or will be seeing very soon, the use of coding-based activities in terms of wearables in design. Mr. Walsh in school has been pushing robotics for years. So there's an integrated approach that's happening across subjects. And I think that that's just as exciting to any girls in the school as to any boys who are coming through the ranks at the moment. That, unfortunately, everybody, is just about all we have time for today. I'd like to thank Annette, Janice, Ruthie, Ashika, and Rohan for their excellent contributions, as well as my co-host, Chloe Jazzy Lau. As Chloe mentioned earlier, we will be back soon with more tech-related content, which continues our focus on diversity in technology. In the meantime, as ever, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. What would you like us to discuss? If you have any ideas, questions, or feedback, then please write to digileaders@webmail.sis.edu.hk. As always, thanks for listening.